Welcome along to the Matchbook Betting Podcast, the show dedicated to bringing you betting insights to help you make smarter and more informed bets. I'm Emmett Kennedy, alongside Matchbook's big bet expert, Mr. Jesse May.
Happy to be here, Emmett. What a great start to the NFL season we had. When the unexpected happens, you know you're in for a great season, betting-wise.
Hopefully this week you will also choose the right bets for us.
Oh yeah, there is that. Speaking of choosing the right bets, can I just give a shout out to the Swami Mike Carlson? The last thing he said on our first show was, wouldn't it be great if Young Ho Koo had a last minute field goal to try and win the game in the win, and then it happens.
Yeah, but as Mike was saying on Twitter, you rarely get pulled that off by icing the kicker. And they managed to pull it off by icing him.
And I hate icing the kicker.
It's the worst.
You know, he waits to the last second, says something to the linesman. The linesman blows the whistle. By the time the whistle goes, the ball's already been put down and it's been kicked in the air. And it's ridiculous. And it wasn't the kid's fault that he missed the second one. The second one was blocked because somebody screwed up in the line.
It was harsh to say the least. And in terms of intros, ladies and gentlemen, Mike Carlson is back.
The guy who can't even wait to be introduced before he starts butting in.
Hammer straight on in there. Mike, you're going to be on TalkSport for the regular season for the NFL, and I assume all the way through to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's with the exception of a couple of games in London I'm doing on television for BBC and the Super Bowl for BBC. We'll be on from 5 to 11 every Sunday night, and then actually it goes over to TalkSport 1, and another crew does the late Sunday night games. We also have the NFL show on Tuesday nights from 10 to midnight with Nat Coombs, who hosts the other one as well. So that's a lot of fun.
We've also got OC as well, who's just ridiculously good. Speaking of ridiculous,
I love working with OC.
He is brilliant.
It's so much fun. You know,
really
and, I don't get that many chances to do it, but
no, he's class.
The Super Bowls have been great.
Speaking of legends, he's only made one appearance on the Matchbook Betting Podcast so far. It was a legendary appearance. We're glad to welcome him back. And this time we're not discussing ice hockey. This time it's NFL the whole way through. From the Bet on the Board podcast, Todd Furman, welcome back to the show.
I mean, you guys set me up on such a pedestal. I can only have one place to go, and it's straight down from that verbose intro. And when we talk about the NHL, maybe we should break down win totals. Our beloved Golden Knights dropped the puck here in a few short weeks, but I know the NFL is king when it comes to the betting markets, especially here in the States. So thank you guys for the opportunity to join you not only this week, but throughout the course of the regular season.
Looking forward to working with you throughout the whole season as well. And of course, we couldn't go anywhere without the Betting Emporium founder, Mr. Neil Channing.
Oh, bless you. I feel like I'm struggling behind a bunch of experts here.
Not at all. And there are lots of content which Neil has contributed to as well on the Matchbook side, insights.matchbook.com. And this is the biggest ever season for Matchbook with the NFL, Jesse, and some huge offers on the site.
There are. And we've got some in-play offers. We're really, the in-play on the games, on the NFL games, is really heated up. So there's some good lines there. But basically, you know, you won't find a tighter spread. You won't find a lower commission. And look, our market and the UK guys love the NFL, and I think we're best priced nearly always.
Fantastic. Let's see about Sunday night's game. So first of all, Sunday night football on NBC, Aaron Rodgers taking one of the best leagues offenses, the Packers, to face Super Bowl runners-up, the Atlanta Falcons. What's the market currently like on Matchbook, Jesse?
So it's Green Bay getting 3. And as we know, Neil Channing was big on Green Bay. He hit him straight. We passed for the charity against Seattle, but I have to admit to barreling in myself when the line went to 2.5. So I'd like to hear if he's on him now with the under-over at 54.
Yeah, you sticking with him, Neil?
Well, I'm quite nervous, actually. I mean, last week I was a bit nervous. A lot of smart money seemed to come for Seattle last week, but I don't know. I'd made my bet on Thursday, so I just had to sit and kind of sit and suffer until the kickoff, and then it wasn't too bad. But, you know, the danger in week two is always that you overreact to what happened in week one. You know, the NFL is such an interesting league because 16 games is a really small sample size. And at certain stages of the season, you're basing the information on stuff that you saw last year. Then you have to factor in stuff that happened in the draft. Then you have to factor in stuff that happened in the preseason. Then you have to factor in stuff that's happened in this season. And one of the reasons that you can beat the NFL market is, well, I believe, is because of recency bias. People overfactor in the thing that they've just seen, and that is basically the definition of recency bias. So, you know, after week one, we can look and say, well, we still have to consider the things that happened last year. We still have to think about the things that happened in the draft and the you know, out of season period. We still have to consider things that happened in the preseason, although, you know, a lot of people would tend to say that's a load of old rubbish. But generally speaking, what happens in the market is that people overreact to what they saw in just that one game in week one. In this particular game, I've said all that. In this particular game, it doesn't make much difference because you know, both neither team has managed to humiliate themselves in week one, and the market hasn't got a chance to sort of overreact. I mean, Atlanta, possibly you could say, well, they didn't cover, did they? They won their game without covering, so perhaps they were a little bit disappointing. I did see one trend that I thought was quite interesting. Playoff teams in week two, you know, getting their home opener in week two. So you made the playoffs last year and you're making your home opener in week two, 37-23 against the spread, which I guess that makes sense in terms of overreaction. People tend to, you know, if they've played on the road in week one, then they're less likely to have won in week one. I don't know. I mean, I'm probably not going to play a side here. The line opened up. It was 2.5 in places. It got to 3 pretty quickly. But it looks like the public are probably going to back Green Bay, I would guess. The line's sort of 3, but you've got to bet odds on if you want to back Green Bay plus 3. I was a bit more interested in the total, really. It is, on the face of it, a high total at 54. And, of course, there is a coaching change in Atlanta which might make a difference to the way they play. And I've heard a couple of people already say, oh, well, you know, you can't just blindly back over Atlanta because it's all going to be different this year. Of course, that is the classic reacting to 1 week of information. I'm going to say that, you know, let's have a think about the way they played last year. And generally speaking, you know, I'd be happy to see them as an over team. If it, just on the trends, I went back to 2010 just because I wanted to have a reasonable sample. Although I would understand your argument if you said, well, what difference does it matter what happened in 2010-11? In games where they're a home favourite, Atlanta have gone over 26 and under 21 and one tie in that time. And in games where they were favourite, 38, 33 and 4. And Green Bay, they in games where they're an underdog, 18 and 12 to the over. And in games where they're an away underdog, 15 and 10 to the over. So I don't know. That was my bet in the game, over 54. I think it's two sides that, you know, they basically get the scoreboard rolling.
So, Mike, you've heard from Neil. Falcons with their 23.
Oh, really?
No, that went long. Sorry about that.
Sorry, I went out for dinner and came back.
I made a tea during that and came back in. I had a feeling that was going to go on for about 8 minutes. Falcons with their 23-17 win over the Bears. Green Bay having to really rally, but in the end, strong defensive play to sack Wilson, which set up that touchdown run, a 17-9 victory for them against one of the best defenses in the league. How do you see this game going?
I'm not convinced. We think of the games that Atlanta and Green Bay play as being shootouts, but that's really based on a small sample of a couple of playoff games. Atlanta ran into a surprisingly strong Chicago defense. And I say surprisingly just because nobody was really thinking about it, I think. But the Bears played really good defensively. And I think Neil was spot on about the sort of adjustment period for the Falcons to get used to a new offensive coordinator. They weren't doing a lot of the things that they did last year offensively. And part of that was Chicago making it difficult for them. But part of it was also, I think, the difference in play calling. For Green Bay, they played really well defensively against Seattle. The offense took time to get clicking, but that's because Seattle's defense is pretty formidable as well. My only worry is outside of Green Bay, I almost think they're going to have to put up points in order to beat Atlanta. I think they can, but the way that their offense functions, they're going to need to beat Atlanta's secondary a lot in man in man coverage, maybe Ty Montgomery out there. And I kind of like Green Bay almost straight up. I'm tending that way. But I think that's partly, as Neil was saying, it's partly an emotional kind of thing, as we just think of Green Bay as being that kind of team, and of Aaron Rodgers as being the kind of guy who can pull things out of his hat where Matt Ryan maybe can't.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of variance in the in these scores. If you're talking 54 points, that's a big total. Could we see like teams get ahead by 2-3 touchdowns here either way? Is it that kind of game where there's going to be
it's quite possible. And if Green Bay get ahead, you think they might be able to play some pretty good defense. But, you know, look at the Super Bowl, and Atlanta was up 28-3 and then couldn't score from that point. But the Super Bowl would have covered a 54 spread.
Quick things, guys, to add to this game. I mean, this will be the third meeting that these teams have played, all actually in Atlanta, since October 30th in 2016. And we look at some of the other numbers. It's kind of fascinating when you consider both the previous meetings had 65 points scored. The playoff game, where Atlanta absolutely boat raced Green Bay 44-21 in a game that was a barn burner during the regular season at 33-32. But the most interesting angle for me is what has really changed a ton. Atlanta ultimately closed as a 6-point favorite in the NFC Championship. Now we're looking at them as, we'll call it a, you know, 2.5-point favorite, that I see that you guys have are 3 with a little bit of vig attached there. So it's an interesting matchup in that regard, because the biggest piece that Atlanta lost from last season to this season isn't anywhere on the field. And I think you guys touched on it with the loss of Kyle Shanahan as their offensive coordinator. You mentioned the new state. You mentioned the first home game. This will be the first ever game played at the Mercedes-Benz Dome in Atlanta. So a lot of interesting storylines to try and create from a side perspective. And if you believe in Aaron Rodgers trying to get revenge for the game that went haywire, I can see you guys making a strong case for Green Bay being a live underdog here.
And that is Sunday Night Football on NBC, live on Sky Sports. If you want to stay up real late, like, of course, we all will be. The second game we're going to talk about is the Cowboys heading to Denver after their opening win over bitter rivals, the Giants. Hi, Jesse May. Jason Witten scored the only touchdown while breaking the franchise record for yards received, as the Cowboys managed to shackle the Giants, who only got 3 on the day. They take on the Broncos, who had that blocked late field goal, which we just talked about earlier on, to beat the Chargers 24-21. Mike Carlson, set this one up for us.
There's still no one's really convinced by Trevor Siemian's performance for Denver against the Chargers. What was rather encouraging for them was to get a steady ground game from C.J. Anderson and Jamaal Charles, who's back after 2 years recuperating a knee injury, the former Chief player. Now, when they're playing against Dallas, Dallas's defense was much better, I think, than most people expected, but it was helped by the fact that the Giants were missing Odell Beckham, and they didn't seem to be able to put together a reasonable facsimile of a passing game without him. And it's always tough to go into Denver for any team. And I was amazed that the Chargers were able to mount such a good comeback in the fourth quarter, because teams often run out of gas in the fourth quarter at Denver. But, you know, to lose 24-21 on a blocked field goal that would have tied the game is probably as Charger a loss as you could get, or at least as Philip Rivers a loss as you could get. And I suspect Dallas is going to be a different kettle of fish for them. Denver's defense is what has made this team for the past 3 seasons. And, you know, in that sense, Trevor Siemian is no worse than Peyton Manning was or Brock Osweiler was during their Super Bowl season. But Denver's defense, at least in week one, was not the Denver defense of the past couple of years. And I kind of edge toward Dallas in this one, too. And I hate this feeling of edging toward road teams, just in principle.
And I'm glad that you focused on the Cowboys' defense, first of all, because whatever about Dak and having Ezekiel Elliott there and a fit again Dez Bryant and that incredible catch from Beasley, there were lots of positives to talk about on offense. But the defense was the thing that I think surprised a lot of people. It certainly surprised me, because talk over the summer was that was going to be, and we discussed it last week as well, was not only would it not be as strong, but also it would lack depth for later in the season. But there was a lot of positives to take from Sunday.
especially sacking, you know, getting to Eli Manning and making life difficult for him, because pass rush was really the big thing that we thought they just wouldn't be able to have. And when you can rush the passer, it makes your secondary better, and their secondary is a kind of work in progress.
So, Todd, exploiting a profit from Cowboys Denver, which way do you want to approach this game?
For me, I want to try and reserve judgment when you look at this Cowboys defense and how they perform week one against the Giants. For the simple fact, I think that was more a byproduct of the Giants' ineffectiveness on the offensive line. Dallas, in terms of being able to put pressure on opposing quarterbacks, if they can do it again this week, Denver, of course, still has some major concerns on their offensive line as well. We saw Ingram and Bosa converge on Simeon, probably a lot more than Bronco fans would like. But you guys mentioned the Denver defense. It's clearly not as stout a unit as what we've seen in recent seasons. They're a little bit soft up the middle, which I think Dallas can kind of exploit. They're going to lean on Ezekiel Elliott. He had a very workmanlike effort in his season debut. No reason to believe that he's not going to get his 20 to 25 touches this week again up there. We've seen a little money coming initially on this total, open 42.5, 43 in some spots, trending down. But as this number creeps up with some Dallas money that I think is largely public cash, coming in on the Cowboys, I'd love nothing more than to be able to back a team that I still think has the better defense in Denver in the home underdog role. I don't love the short week. I don't like how they finished the game against the San Diego Chargers, but we know how tough it is to try and get any win, no matter where you're playing against a division rival. And I think Dak's going to find it tough sledding to throw against his secondary. So for me, I'll make a case for Denver being very live in the home underdog role if they're able to at least neutralize Ezekiel Elliott.
Just real quick, people talk about a trap game, and you look at that number, you know, Dallas by 1.5. They were kind of the big story of week one, and Denver, you know, looked bad. Is this kind of like a trap game there where everyone's just going to go nuts on Dallas?
I think you guys mentioned it earlier. Recency bias plays such a role in the National Football League, and it's one of the greatest tools that you can use as a bettor to try and exploit some value and grab that extra half point, full point, or even a point and a half in some instances. And what you'll see here is I'd have to imagine the general public will probably come in at about a 75% clip backing this Dallas defense that they've become enamored with. But the Giants didn't have the weapons. The Giants didn't have the offensive line. And by no stretch of the imagination is Denver going to remind us of the 2007 New England Patriots. With C.J. Anderson out there and the 1-2 punch we saw with Jamal Charles, Trevor Siemian looked much more comfortable. And if we erase the interception on the screen pass that allowed San Diego to get back in the game, or Charles fumble late, we could be talking about Denver having beaten the Chargers comfortably by double digits, and most likely you could see Denver opening as a 1-point favorite. So glad to take them catching a few points here in their own building.
And the market, Jesse, on Matchbook?
Well, right now, as you say, Dallas is a 1.5-point favorite, and I guess that it's going to shade all the way. I mean, if I was going to think about it, I'd go late and see if it got to 2.5. And I would say that it might move there. I don't know. Mike, would you talk us out of this, really?
What? You talk you out of what? Backing Denver? Never at home. I mean, Denver has to be really bad. You almost think, you know, normally home field advantage is worth 3 points. You know, more or less. But in Denver, it really ought to be worth 4, I think.
On to the next game. 2 games in commitment defeat on week one. Talk of an unbeaten season up in smoke for the Patriots. And they will face the Saints. You can't have avoided it. Adrian Peterson has come out since and said it was no thing. But that stare and that shout at Coach Payton when he wasn't brought in towards the end, it just told its own story. This week it's going to be Brady against Breeze and Peterson. Let's get the betting on Matchbook from Jesse.
Well, I think the line opened around 4, and now it's like 6.5. you know, I mean, I thought both these teams were horrible. So I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I'm not sure Adrian Peterson knows what's going on either, because it's a different system that they play with the Saints. He'll be slotted into rotation, and he only had 6 carries for 18 yards in his homecoming game as well, and it did not go to plan for him at all. Mike, sum this game up for us.
Well, the interesting thing is everybody's so excited. You just don't expect a New England team to lose 2 weeks in a row, and the Saints are by no means Kansas City, you know, defensively at all. I'm tempted here because the Saints' offensive line is a mess. They couldn't really do the kinds of things they wanted to do, either running or passing. One of the crazy things about this game was that Adrian Peterson, as you mentioned, was 6 carries for 18 yards. Ingram was 6 carries for 17 yards, and Kamara was 7 carries for 18 yards. So the three running backs were like the three clones of mediocrity, but that's a factor of their offensive line. They've got both their starting tackles out. And New England, well, they don't have a whole lot of pass rush, but when you're working against second-string tackles, you ought to be able to manufacture something. The problem for the Patriots is partly the loss of players to retirement, injury, whatever, have come at two positions, which is the edge, the defensive end, and outside linebacker. Last week they had Hightower playing outside, which is not where they need him the most. But and then he got hurt, but he could well wind up playing this week. And of course they lost another receiver, Amendola, to concussions. So they may only have three wide receivers. One of them is Brandon Cooks, who comes back to New Orleans for his welcome back game. I just think that Belichick's not going to get outsmarted, say, by Sean Payton, and they're going to exploit the weaknesses of this team. Ted Ginn is not Brandon Cooks. They don't have a deep threat that they need to stop, and the Patriots don't really need to take anybody out of the game, which means they can play a pretty standard kind of defense, and I think that'll be enough to stop Minnesota. However, you know, being 6.5-point favorites on the road to a high-scoring team is not a great situation for them.
No.
And I just thought Sean Payton should have turned around and looked at Adrian Peterson and said, "Hey, didn't you used to be Adrian Peterson?"
Oh, harsh, but fair. Todd, we've got into the routine of expecting Belichick to work things out, just to be able to fix the problems within the organization, and they will solve these issues. So the Edelman issue, the fact that he's out for the season, they just work things out. But maybe that's going to be a little bit more difficult, or do you expect them to just correct things this week?
You know what? I don't want to say that you just wave the magic wand and all of a sudden things are going to be rosy and we're going to return to the talk that now the Patriots got their loss out of the way. They're going to run the table and go 18-1 the remainder of the season and win another Lombardi trophy. Edelman was the safety blanket and the safety valve for Tom Brady. So with him out, you had to adjust a little bit. You guys mentioned the concussion of Amendola. The receiving core for New England right now at this point in the season is extremely depleted. Brandon Cooks' ability to stretch the field is great. Hogan, we know, is very limited in his ability to go one-on-one with defensive backs, just given his size. And Rob Gronkowski, I don't feel like he was at his best week one against Kansas City. So aside from that, you have Malcolm Mitchell on the PUP list, which I'm sure Bill Belichick may regret at this point. So where do the big plays come from the Patriots? You have to look in the backfield. I think we're going to see a steady dose of James White. Rex Burkhead may take on a larger workload. Aside from the three touchdowns from Mike Gillisley, I mean, he was pretty ineffective in short yardage. It's rare to see the Patriots get stopped on fourth and short, not once in a game, but twice. And defensively, you guys talked about some of the reshuffling there. Rob Ninkovich retires, Dante Hightower a little bit out of position. And there were more breakdowns in one half of football for my eyes for the Patriots against the Chiefs than what we've grown accustomed to seeing over the course of an entire season. This number, though, I mean, getting close to a full touchdown, shouldn't there be a little bit of recency bias favoring almost the Saints? But maybe the market feels the Saints weren't any better in their loss against the Vikings. I just feel like this is a rich price tag. And for a high scoring game, you're going to want to try and take all those valuable points. But for me, I think the total might be the most manageable element. I actually made the total about 5 points higher than what the market has. And while I'm skeptical of New England's ability to get chunk yardage and beat the Saints at their own game, I think 55.5 is more than manageable to try and go over.
Jesse, is that the total we're getting on Matchbook?
Wow, that's an interesting analysis, Todd. Over 55.5, but you think the Patriots are going to be running a lot. That seems like a lot of points.
Well, I don't know if they're going to necessarily be running. I think we're going to see them lean on their running backs catching balls out of the backfield, almost like we saw from the Patriots in the Super Bowl, where James White became their most valuable receiver, taking advantage out in space and giving these guys an opportunity to make defenders miss one-on-one. We saw Dalvin Cook on Monday night have some success getting to the edge in the ground game. I think New England would be more than happy to try and throw the ball out of the backfield, check down quite a bit, and look for those opportunities to hit Cooks over the top for the big play.
It's really interesting, Todd, and I wouldn't be surprised. He was inactive in week one, but the as their third tight end, the Patriots kept an undrafted kid from Wyoming called Jacob Hollister, who's really a move tight end. And it occurred to me that with only three wide receivers, they could run from three tight end sets and put this kid in motion. And with New Orleans playing in what will probably be at least just a base defense against a three tight end set, he could be the kind of guy who gets downfield the way Gronk should have done, but seemed unable to against the Chiefs.
And that is going to be a cracker. Two teams who badly need a win after week one defeats. Now, we were going through with the lads what games they wanted to talk about this week. And for some reason, Neil Channing wants to talk about Cardinals at Colts. I'm hoping
it is a cracker, isn't it? The Cards are on the road to Indy. Well, because I just wanted to illustrate, you know, one of the points I was making earlier, which is, you know, that recency bias is probably the biggest factor as to why it's possible to win in the NFL market. I mean, people sometimes say, and matchbook has become such a dominant thing in the NFL market, you know, huge amounts of volume on there. And some people say to me, well, how can you beat that? There's, there's 100 grand either side is some of the smartest guys in the world that you're playing against. But the point is that the market gets put out of kilter by a big amount of what you would perhaps call recreational or public money. Now, it may be changing a little bit in recent years in that some of these syndicates are getting so big now that even the tens of thousands of people having $10 on or whatever can't really make up for the five or six groups having a million on. Generally speaking, the market does get pushed about by the recreational money a little bit, or not so much pushed about by it, but there can be an anticipation in the early lines as to the way the money's going to go. Now, this game, there was a prediction before last week's games that this game would open up with Arizona being about a 3.5-point favorite. Now, Arizona clearly had a pretty bad week. They lost their running back, and they didn't look very good on offense anyway. And, you could say that they didn't really deserve, if Indy had had just a sort of average week, they didn't really deserve to be much higher than the 3.5-point favorite. Now, clearly, Indy had a horrible week and got completely caned. And obviously, Tolzien is a pretty terrible quarterback. But the line is 7.5. I mean, you know, this is a massive, massive difference. And, I just feel like I like backing home dogs anyway. I'll give you one trend I saw. If you bet home dogs off a loss of 20 or more, that's home dogs who are dogs of 7 or more points. If they lost the previous week by 20 or more, you just have a bet in all those situations, bet blindly. You'll have had 44 winners and 26 losers against the spread. So that's pretty good. If you took home dogs after a week one loss, you'd be on a run of 31 winners and 20 losers. So that's a pretty good thing as well. I if you take home dogs off a week one loss in week two, just since 2005, 30 winners and 14 losers. Now, I don't need to try and tell you that Scott Tolzien's going to suddenly remember that, he's becoming Joe Montana overnight. He's obviously awful, but it's NFL any given Sunday. Well, and I'm talking about prices here. And at this price, you've just got to back Indy. And I could actually see this one moving. I think I could see the syndicates playing this one. And it wouldn't surprise me if this moved through the 7 points and got to 6.5. By 6 p.m. Sunday.
I kind of agree with you on this, but Tolzien's not going to be playing. And
Did I say something stupid?
He's going to get the start, and that's probably a big positive for Indianapolis. And, of course, Arizona's without David Johnson, and he is their offense. So everybody's looking at Arizona's racking up a lot of points against Indianapolis because they'll hit the deep ball. But Carson Palmer looked really awful on Sunday. I was just surprised at how inaccurate he was and how he was basically forcing balls. And I think Brissett can probably do enough with his feet to keep Indianapolis at least close for much of the game. And you have an excuse if you're Chuck Pagano for not starting Brissett, because after preseason and all you know about Scott Tolzien, you have to know he's not going to win games in the NFL, and they only picked up Brissett right before the season started. But, you know, it was like a no-brainer for him to go in and start. And I like Indianapolis at home in this one, even though they're a terrible football team and Arizona isn't.
Jesse, what price can we get in the Colts?
Listen, I love it. There's nothing I like better than backing a bad football team on the handicap. That's like milk and honey to me. But if you want to get 7.5, Neil, you're looking at laying, it's about 1.85 or something. You think that's worth it?
Okay. Well, that's not too bad. I wouldn't mind doing that. I wouldn't want to go down to 1.82, but 1.85 is not too bad. I don't know. What do you think, Todd? Do you think there's a chance that this becomes a big professional bet this week?
I think you guys made some compelling cases, and there's no doubt about it that if you're going to see professional money in this game, it'll come in on the Colts. Perfect opportunity to try and buy a stock at the low, given how poorly they performed in their trip out west and getting embarrassed by the Rams 46-9. Arizona, I mean, we talk about it all the time, the adjustments the market makes for a skilled position player. You know, there are guys in the league that at the top, unless you were talking about quarterbacks, they're only worth about a point to a point and a half. But I think we've seen this Arizona offense without David Johnson. You don't replace 2,000 yards of total offense and the 20 touchdowns he contributed a season ago, given Carson Palmer's declining skill set this late. I do worry about, regardless of who Indy starts at quarterback and how they elect to split reps between Tolzien and Jacoby Brissett against an Arizona defense that I think is still talented. But guess what? They're going to have to score some points. And as long as the Colts don't turn the ball over and create short fields, I have zero confidence in Arizona's ability to go up and down the field. I mean, they couldn't run the ball last week. I mean, Carson Palmer was a turnover waiting to happen. If you can grab the 7.5 and even at a price, I think it makes a lot of sense. But even at 7, which is a little bit more advantageous, it wouldn't shock me if Arizona ends up winning this game, but only by a field goal.
Okay, and finally, Vikings at Steelers. Bradford had what many consider to be his best game in the NFL on week one as they beat the Saints. As for the Steelers, a lot of criticism for the ineffective Le'Veon Bell, who skipped the training camp due to a contract dispute as they beat the Browns 21-18. Mike, set the scene for this one.
Well, you had it exactly right. Bradford's game was pretty good, and partly because he wasn't constantly checking down to receivers and throwing short of the first down sticks. But the big thing behind that was the rookie Dalvin Cook at running back, who had just a tremendous game, and it made their offensive line, which has been such a problem for them for the past 2 years, look pretty good and solid. And Adam Thielen, who's one of my favorite players because I love receivers who are described as sneaky fast, which is code for melanin challenged, basically, in the NFL. Thielen had a huge game, and I think proved that he deserves to be up there. He and Stephon Diggs are now a decent pair of receivers. Now, Pittsburgh, you said Le'Veon Bell didn't look ready. And it was kind of optimistic of them to throw him in right away, because there's, even if you're in good shape, there's a difference between good shape and game shape. Cleveland are a surprisingly strong team defensively, and the thing with Pittsburgh, well, there were two things that were impressive. One was that they got some really good defense themselves from TJ Watts, JJ Watts' younger brother, who's a rookie, and Anthony Chiquillo, who had been a sort of forgotten guy on their bench. And they had two sacks apiece. Stephon Tuitt is out for them, which will hurt their defense a little bit. And Antonio Brown was the man, as he usually is, for Pittsburgh. Now, Minnesota's a strong defensive team, and they've got the kind of defensive backs who can basically take most of Pittsburgh's receivers out of the game. And I think this one really boils down to how much faith you have in two of the three killer bees for Pittsburgh, in Ben and Antonio Brown, Ben Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown. Can they carry the team on the road and at home, where they have a big advantage against Minnesota? I think this is really a big test for Minnesota. You know, are they going to challenge Green Bay in that division? If they can win on the road, then they can. And, you know, Mike Zimmer, their coach, used to coach in Cincinnati. He knows Pittsburgh well. He knows what you need to do to be able to stop them. The only question is whether they'll be able to do it.
Vikings have been quietly talked up this season, Mike. We've only had just the 1 week in preseason, but how far do you think early predictions?
Yeah.
But how far do you think they can go this season?
It's what Aaron Schatz called national jump on the bandwagon week. Minnesota were my dark horse sort of pick in the NFC, and that's basically to make the playoffs as a wild card team. But as I said, they're a solid team. They play good defense. If Sam Bradford can play the way he did last Sunday every week, then they're in with a really good shot. And this will be the test for them. Pittsburgh's defense looked better than you expect, but that was against a rookie quarterback in Cleveland. I think there's opportunities there.
So, Todd, a huge test for the Vikings this weekend and a huge test for Bradford to kind of stick it in the eye to all the critics and prove that he can be consistent and an elite quarterback in the NFL. What are you expecting, Viking Steelers?
I'm going to take a different approach here, and I'm going to watch the market as it trends. I mean, off of the six, I think you're going to see money come in from the general public looking to back Minnesota on the strength of what was a dominant victory against the Saints on Monday night. The one thing we've grown accustomed to watching the Steelers over the years is they look night and day difference home and road. For whatever reason, if it's preparation that trickles from Mike Tomlin down to his coordinators or the lack of focus from Big Ben and company, the offense always has another gear when they're at Heinz Field compared to what they have on the road. You guys talked about Le'Veon Bell not being in camp and going to need some time to get himself into game shape. Antonio Brown picked up right where he left off. I mean, he was tremendous, as he is almost every single week. I think Bell gets on track and you're going to see a balanced attack. I think we'll see Martavis Bryant get more touches in the offense as well. The pleasant surprise for me last week was the way they used Jesse James, the tight end, to try and take advantage of Cleveland across the middle. A final score, probably a little bit misleading. I will say Cleveland most likely the side, but they did have to get in the back door with a late touchdown and the two-point conversion, ultimately lose by a field goal. But as this number comes down, I think this might be an opportunity to kind of buy low on Pittsburgh. I personally made the game 7, so at 5.5, I'd love the game to tick down to 4.5, maybe even 4 if it gets there. Not sure it will, but I'll make a case for laying the points with the favorite more so than backing the underdog.
Sounds good. And Neil, how are you going to approach it?
That's kind of, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, clearly, many more people watch Monday Night Football than any of the other games. And Minnesota were impressive on Monday Night Football. I'd also say that in the time since they moved into the new stadium, they're kind of a sort of a sneaky home field advantage. People talk a lot about teams like Denver and Seattle having big home field advantage. I don't hear people saying that so much about Minnesota. And I think they're one of these teams where you can't give them more than 3 for a home field advantage. So perhaps that performance on Monday night, doesn't have to be overvalued. You need to be careful about overvaluing that because it was with that strong home advantage. I sort of was looking at the under in this game, and I just wondered whether the guys had any thoughts on unders generally. We spoke a little bit last week about how defenses generally tend in the first 3 or 4 weeks of the season to be in the ascendancy because it's a little bit harder for people to learn offense there, and also the defensive players are more fresh and not banged up. And of course, I then suggested we use that information to bet under in a New England game. So what an idiot I am. But if we'd have bet under in virtually any of the other games, it would have been quite a good idea. I noticed this week, it doesn't feel to me like the market's overreacting to 1 week of stats on a whole bunch of games going under. They've all opened up kind of roughly where I thought they would open up. I don't know. I'm kind of anticipating that to carry on at least through week 2. Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
For me personally, I tend to gravitate towards playing unders, especially early in the season, for a lot of those reasons. Defense, I mean, you're reading and reacting more so than offenses that aren't clicking on all cylinders. And I'll go one step further. When I'm playing totals in the NFL, we've made a habit and we've tried to drum it into a lot of our loyal podcast listeners at Bet the Board that splitting your action or going exclusively over the first half makes a lot more sense given the trends that we've seen in the National Football League. As these games get away, teams may open up their playbook a lot more in the second half, especially if you have one team playing from behind that has to completely abandon the run. Whereas the first 30 minutes, it's almost a more low variance game. Teams come in with a game plan. They're not going to deviate from that early on. If you're down 7 to 10 points, you can still stay committed if you're a ground and pound offense. You don't have to kind of get away from it. And they're perfect examples, though, of knowing what those key numbers are in the market, specifically right around three touchdowns. The difference between 20.5 versus 21.5, 23.5 to 24. And oftentimes the first half derivative markets don't respond quite the same way as the full game match markets. So we found an awful lot of opportunity to take advantage of betting these games in the first 30 minutes exclusively for unders, whereas over bettors should try and take full advantage of the full 60, because you get a good chance for a lot of garbage points late in the game.
And Jesse, what kind of price can we get on those markets on Matchbook?
Jeez, I'm loving that analysis, Todd. That makes a lot of sense to me. Let me see. Well, if you want to go first half under for the – well, now I know it's there. I'm not seeing it right now, but I know they do spread it. But I guess, you know, being that it's 45 in the full game right now, you would want to be looking at, 23 rather than 22.5. I guess that's what Todd's saying.
Yeah, exactly. That would kind of be the buy price. And I know as we're recording, it's probably a little early in the week for some of the halftime markets to be open up. But you mentioned the key numbers. Such a huge difference between 22.5 and 23 if you're looking at the angles there. So if you wanted to try and play that 23, would probably be the buy point. Since there's no chance we're going to be able to get a 24, I can't see this total trending back up to that 47.5, 48 range anytime soon.
Sounds good.
Can I give you one great over under to end with?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah, Houston and Cincinnati are playing Thursday night. The two teams, they combined for 7-3 points. They combined for 7 points. Take the over on 7.
what kind of price do we need to back over 7 in a derivative market there, guys?
I think it'll probably be pretty good.
That's insane for a Thursday night short week, isn't it?
Isn't it?
The Texans are extremely banged up. I mean, we saw off their offensive line get gashed. I mean, the Jaguars had 10 sacks. Tom Savage and Deshaun Watson for running for their lives. They had to upgrade a tight end from their practice squad. I think that was part of the reason prompting Coach O'Brien to use Deshaun Watson, because Savage would be a sitting duck back there. But 38 in the NFL in this day and age is awfully tricky to try and handle and navigate through. So just, for me, I'll be on the sideline.
Just quickly on that game, the side opened up 3. Cincy opened up 3. That's moved up to kind of 6.5. It would be pretty tempting, even though I appreciate that Houston are banged up and it's a short week and they got to travel and they have the distractions of, the terrible stuff that's been going on in Texas. 7 points is very valuable in a low-scoring game, much more valuable than in a high-scoring game. And with the total at 38, is a very correlated thing. If you can get the correlated parlay +7 and under 38. That's pretty hard to get that in the UK, but you can get that in the States, I think.
And on that bombshell, we are done. My sincere thanks. I'm loving this. The NFL is back. It's huge on Matchbook, but it's going to be bigger than ever on the Matchbook Betting Podcast, with the help, as always, of Neil Channing. We'll chat to you a little bit later on about the St. Ledger, a little bit later on Saturday, live and at the races. Thanks once again to Mike Carlson. Great to have your company.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Looking forward to the All-Ireland.
We're cheering on Mayo, isn't that right?
That's what I've been told.
Screw you, Dublin. We're coming for you. I'm a Kilkenny man, by the way. So we don't even play football in Kilkenny. Like, I really have no dog in the fight. I just want to see Mayo finally win. And Todd Furman from the Bet the Board podcast, looking forward to working with you alongside Mike and Neil throughout the rest of the season on Matchbook.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And thanks for getting up so early in Vegas as well. Glad to be company. We'll chat to you again very soon.
Looking forward to it.
Premier League now on the Matchbook Betting Podcast. Welcome back to the show from We Love Betting, Mark O'Hare.
Hi guys, how you doing? Good to be back.
Good to have you back on the show, Mark. And also a man who at this very moment in time is supposed to be on holidays in Florida. Surprisingly, he's decided not to go. In a shocking turn of events. Welcome back to the show, Mark Stitchcomb.
Thank you for the reminder, Emmett.
But wouldn't you rather be on a podcast with Jesse and me as opposed to sitting on a beach getting blown out of it literally by a hurricane?
100%.
Not a hint of sarcasm either, by the way. I take my risk with that storm.
The Matchbook podcast is much better value.
Value waits for no man. Value waits for no man, Mark. You know, it's we can bet now, and then you'll watch the game from the plane.
Yeah, great arrangement.
Yeah, fly Emirates or whatever other airline it is that you want to fly with. Mark has been writing some fantastic content for insights.matchbook.com as well, by the way, which you really should be checking out. The first game we're going to talk about is Super Sunday. It's the London Derby, 1:30 as Chelsea take on Arsenal. The betting on Matchbook, Jesse.
Yeah, this can be a great game, isn't it? Obviously, as we know, we're all over Chelsea this season. We have them in the outright. We hit them on the overs, thanks to Mark, last weekend. So Chelsea at home, they're about 1.82 or 5-6 against Arsenal in the 1-2, -3/4 of a goal, and over-under is 3, Mark.
Mark, you've been banging the drum about Chelsea for a while now, proclaiming them potential champions and a possibility to extract profit from them in the anti-post market. Arsenal have had their struggles this season, to say the least. They were absolutely destroyed by Liverpool. It's been a shaky enough start to the season for them. Can they produce a big performance against Conte's men?
No, I don't think so. Not if Arsene Wenger is not going to change his style of play and respect the fact that he's coming up against better teams and better players. I don't think he can continue to justify playing the likes of Xhaka and Ramsey without any defensive discipline in central midfield. I think they'll just continue to be picked off. I mean, their last 25 matches away against the Big Six, they haven't won a single match, and they've lost 18 of them. I think that's just a damning statistic. And Chelsea have won 16 of their last 18 home matches, which includes taking Arsenal apart 3-1 in February, fairly convincingly. Yeah, I think really straightforward. I think Chelsea over 1.8 are a little bit of value and worth a small bet.
Mark Stitchcomb sounding confident, although he did temper that enthusiasm by saying small bet then towards the end. Mark O'Hare, what about you? How do you see this game going, Mark? I mean, Conte, a frustrating summer for him, to say the least, but they do seem to be rolling now.
Yeah, it's been quite a slow start. Obviously, the Burnley result went against them, but, you know, Chelsea, for having 9 men, could easily get taken a point there, if not all 3. And they've only started to improve thereafter. And you look at the weeks these two teams are going to have coming into this game, and Chelsea had the luxury of resting and rotating 5 players against Carabao on Tuesday night. The Azerbaijani side pretty much gifted them half of their goals anyway, and Gary Cahill got a return from suspension. Just one of 3 changes to that back 5. Eden Hazard got half an hour off the bench as well, so it was basically the perfect warm-up for this sort of game. And coming up off the back of a very good win at Leicester as well last weekend, let's not forget. The Azerbaijani, Karabag, they only had 5 touches in Chelsea's penalty area on Tuesday night, which just shows the dominance they had in that game. And if you compare it to Arsenal, well, yeah, they will rest and rotate in the Europa League against Cologne on Thursday night. But, you know, I'm not expecting that to be an easy ride. It's a huge, huge occasion for Cologne. Their fans are pretty mad, and they're coming over here for a bit of a party, and the team will be really hell-bent on getting a result and a performance at the Emirates. And, you know, I just look at this game, and immediately you think Chelsea win. Arsenal tend to roll over when they come to the bridge, and 6 of their last 8 defeats there have been by at least 2 goals. Mark's already mentioned their woeful record at the top 6 and Chelsea's excellent home record as well. Something that did actually strike me was only West Ham have conceded more goals than Arsenal this season. Oof. And only Bournemouth have allowed more shots on target from inside their penalty area than Arsenal. They're 2 really concerning statistics when you're coming up against a team like Chelsea, who have pretty much had a week's rest since the Leicester game. And as Mark says, you know, anything above 1.8 is great value, but the 3/4 handicap, the Asian handicap for Chelsea, looks like a real piece of value here for me at odds against. Anyway, that's where I'd be heading here.
In terms of the charity bet, as Jesse May revealed in the NFL section earlier, we will find out exactly what way Jesse May is going to lean in terms of the charity bets at the very end of the show. So let's move on to the second Premier League game of the weekend that we're going to discuss. It's Saturday night, 5:30, live on BT Sport, Tottenham Hotspur against Swansea City. Poor old Renato Sanchez had one of the worst debuts in Premier League history at the weekend. We'll see if he can bounce back in this game. Mark Stitchcomb will get your thoughts after the betting from Jesse May.
Big favorites are Tottenham. They play in the Sky Dome now, don't they? And they're 1 point, 1-4 on basically against Swansea, and 1.75 in the handicap. They're giving away that many goals, and over three and under three in the totals.
Looked a bit at sea, Swansea City, at the weekend. And given how good Tottenham Hotspur have been recently, if they can get over this Wembley hoodoo, it's no longer August, so Harry Kane scoring goals, because, you know, that's clearly a statistical fact now. Is this going to be a standard day at the office for Tottenham? And if so, how can we extract a profit from them?
Well, I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about Tottenham's struggles at Wembley, and I'm not convinced that it's a hoodoo or anything like that. I think it is going to take them a while, and they might not even adjust to it at all. And there's a lot of different elements that are affecting their style of play at home, the bigger pitch, the atmosphere, and the opposition seeing it as a big day out at Wembley. And I'm looking to take them on, but Swansea aren't really the ideal opponents to be trying to side with at the moment. They started the season fairly poorly. Their attack is almost non-existent, and they've managed just 7 shots on target so far, which is the second worst in the league. And their expected goals is less than 2.5 after 4 games. So they're really struggling since the departures of Llorente and Sigurdsson. And they just seem to lack a little bit of a game plan. And the last 7 away games actually have been under 2.5 goals. And with Spurs struggling to break teams down at Wembley, they've only actually scored 13 goals in their 12 matches at the new Wembley. Rather than laying Spurs or backing Swansea on the handicap, because I envisage a game of Tottenham attacking and Swansea defending, so I would expect Tottenham to make the breakthrough. But I quite like the under 3 goals here. I think it probably should be a little bit more, about 2.75, with the fact that it's not a team that is going to score bucket loads, because they have struggled at Wembley, and Swansea aren't going to probably bother Tottenham's defence too much. So I think under 3 goals is a decent way of opposing Spurs whilst still sort of keeping them onside a little bit.
When you look at that line, I mean, not only is the over under 3, but it's shading towards 3.25 with being odds against for the under. I mean, why is the public shading towards that high total? What makes it a good place for them not scoring much?
I think basically, as I sort of alluded to on my piece, nobody really knows how much home advantage. No one can really put a number on what Tottenham's home advantage should be at Wembley. Now, tonight they're playing Borussia Dortmund, and Tottenham are favourites, but there's some people that would make the argument that there is no advantage for Tottenham playing at Wembley, and perhaps Dortmund and Spurs, not probably different too much in ability, that perhaps they should be a pick'em. So I think just at the moment, we've only got 2 home games of Spurs data to work with, Chelsea and Burnley, who are obviously miles apart in terms of ability. So I think people are just probably just carrying on Tottenham's data from their White Hart Lane, when you can't really use that too much. But again, nobody really knows what the real answer is.
That makes sense to me.
Mark O'Hare, your thoughts on what Mark Stitchcomb's had to say, just to not confuse things with the two Marks.
I think Mark makes a very good case there. I think that's exactly right. It's just an unknown, isn't it? No one can really put a value on home advantage at Wembley for Spurs at the moment. So until we see what happens in the near future, what happens against Dortmund and certainly against Chelsea, where they were basically the better team, I thought, for the majority of the match, then the bookmakers are basically going on what happened last year at White Hart Lane.
The final game we are going to preview with the two lads this week is the cracker of the weekend, the most anticipated game in the Premier League. I'm amazed this one wasn't moved to Super Sunday. West Bromwich Albion against West Ham United. What could happen? Betting on Matchbook, Jesse May.
You know, I'll watch flies running down the wall if Mark can find us value here. So a battle of the Westies. something where you guys come from. It's black dog in my parlance. West Brom 7-5 in the 1-2 with shading towards 0.25 goal in the handicap. And the over-under is 2.25, Mark O'Hare.
All right, these two old Westie rivals finally get to settle their grudge match on Saturday. Mark O'Hare, this is one of the games you wanted to highlight. Why?
You say it's not being moved to Super Sunday, but did you see the fixtures last weekend? They were dreadful.
God,
anyway.
They were terrible.
It's awful. But I'll start with West Brom, really, because they've had a reasonably cushy start. I think they've played Burnley, Bournemouth, Brighton and Stoke. Did lose at Brighton last weekend. That was their first defeat of the season. But in fairness, they missed quite a few great chances and really should have got something out of that game. And I think Tony Pulis is kind of... he was angry about the performance as well as the result. He felt his team didn't do him or themselves justice. And, you know, he has to look at himself to start with. He selected Solomon Rondon up front, and he'd just come back from travelling, playing in the South American qualifiers for Venezuela just 48 hours earlier. That probably wasn't an ideal situation to be in, although West Brom's record with him starting is only 24 defeats in 64. So you can see he's a very important player. So if he's fit and fresh this weekend, they will be a better team. He probably needs to show a little bit more trust in his team and open them up a little bit more from the sort of 4-1-4-1 formation he seems to choose, especially away from home, because Rondon was so isolated at Brighton last week, and you kind of need a bit more from them going forward. But from all accounts, he called them in for a team meeting on Monday, from what I've heard, and put them through two really hard double sessions on Tuesday in preparation for this weekend. And when West Brom and Tony Pulis' backs are up against the wall, you do expect a response. They've got Hal Robson-Kanu back from suspension. Now, I know that's not exactly a star signing, like, but they've got Johnny Evans and Krakowiak also available and fitter than last week. Chadley is a doubt, but the suggestion is he'll be back as well. And Kieran Gibbs will only be better for his kind of cameo last weekend. So, you know, I do like them at the quotes. I think they're around 2.42 I saw this morning, and they scored in all five of their games this year. They're very much a huge threat from set pieces, and their home record, actually, when you exclude the top seven from last season, 9 wins, 2 draws and 3 defeats. Now, 7 of their last 10 home wins have been by 2 or more goals, and they've only lost by 2 or more goals themselves on 7 occasions since the start of last season. They're always competitive. They're never really fare too well in the performance data. Defensively, they're very strong too. Only the top 8 conceded fewer goals last season, and only Spurs have faced more shots on target so far this season. Obviously, there's a caveat of the fixture list playing into their hands so far this season, but they are effective in both boxes, and as I said, I do expect a big response from them this weekend. Just on West Ham, you know, they got their first points on Monday, and although the data suggests it was quite a comfortable win, it was a dire game, and the first goal was a huge deflection. Relieved a lot of pressure on them, really, and Slaven Bilic was even admitted after the game he sort of feared for the sack if they didn't get a result on Monday, which just kind of shows the air of uncertainty around the club at the moment. No side's conceded more goals than them this season. They've lost all 3 away games, conceding 10 goals. And if also you look at their record against teams in 13th and above, now West Brom did finish above them last year as well. They only won once, drew 3 and lost 8, and conceded at least twice in 8 of those 11 games. So at the prices, you know, I do like West Brom. They never fare well in the performance data. They're always a little bit generously priced when they're at home because of that. And I think there's a good opportunity to get with them this weekend, because I do expect a big response.
Yeah, I'm liking your thinking. Of course, the key attribute here is that West Ham have got Joe Hart in goal. So just shoot low to the left and you'll be all right. You'll score, surely. Mark Stitchcomb, do you back up Mark O'Hare's assessment that this is a good bet for West Brom at the weekend?
Yeah, I think that was a pretty comprehensive view on the game. And I echo your thoughts on Joe Hart. He just I didn't think he was that bad a goalkeeper. But having watched him in over the last few games, I've downgraded my opinion. He's absolutely woeful.
Terrible.
But what I don't get about this is West Ham, obviously Joe Hart's a big name. Well, he's a huge name. He's the number one goalkeeping name in this country. But there was no one watching him last season because he was absolutely wretched for Torino. And I know Torino's defence is pretty porous, but even their president came out after the season and said he was basically the worst signing they've made. So I don't know what they were thinking then in bringing him in on such huge wages as well. It's a crazy decision.
Maybe Bilic had this obsession with signing players who were really good in 2010. and it'll work with Chicharito, but whether or not it's going to work with Zabaleta and Hart, it's definitely not going to work at Hart anyway. But look, it's going to be a compelling case from Mark O'Hare for Tony Pulis' side to get the job done this weekend. A compelling case from Mark Stitchcomb made for his bets as well. I'm looking forward to it. At the end of the podcast, we'll find out in which way Jesse May wants to lean in terms of the charity bets. Lads, it's a pleasure chatting to you. Mark, hopefully we'll have you back on the show again soon. Mark Stitchcomb, does this mean that you are now going to head on holidays to Florida and brave all the storms?
Yes, if the airports allow.
You are nuts, but I admire it. I love that kind of crazy. Have fun. Enjoy the hurricanes and whatever else is there. And
roller coasters.
And roller coasters and the hurricanes. And we're not just talking about the Disneyland theme park. Pleasure talking to you as always. Mark Ayer, great to have you back on the show. We'll chat to you again soon.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Great stuff.
Finally, on the Matchbook Betting Podcast, let's take a look at the last classic of the season in horse racing. It is the St. Ledger Stakes, over a mile and 6.5 furlongs, if you want to be really technical about it. It's the oldest classic in the book, and it will be live on At The Races, 3:35 at Doncaster on Saturday. To preview the race, we are joined by the Betting Emporium godfather himself, Mr. Neil Channing.
Oh, hello.
And from betting expert, it's Stephen Harris.
Hi, chaps.
So, wide open betting heat, Jesse May. Take us through it. We've got three horses that are barely split at the top of the market.
The Crystal Ocean and Defoe. All around 5-1, 4-1, 5-1.
And then even Stradivarius isn't too far off them. Rekindling Venice Beach, who was second last time out, to Cracksman. This is a really, really interesting race. We've got Defoe, who's got a lot of ones behind his name, but hasn't exactly gone down the traditional St. Ledger trial route. Crystal Ocean, who at one point was being highly touted for the Derby at Epsom, ended up skipping that race but looked good last time. And Capri, who did run in the Derby, was all at sea that day but got a Derby to his name by winning the Irish Derby at the Curragh last time out when he beat the aforementioned Cracksman. And then we've got Stradivarius, a winner at the Royal Meeting and at Glorious Goodwood as well. This is a fascinating race, Stephen Harris.
Yeah, it's a brilliant race, Emmett. I think it's a race I'm tempted, and I know you're going to disagree, to put my bookmaker hat on Matchbook at the moment. The front two, Capri and Crystal Ocean, are around about 4-1 or a shade under that. You put them in the hod together, it's under 6-4 coupled, and I think it's a very fair price to lay. Both of them are doubtful stayers, in my opinion. We've just watched Doncaster today. We're recording this on Wednesday evening, and there's been a really strong headwind. They've been finishing very tired. Now, weather forecasts vary, and I know Emmett's got a hotline into the weather world, but the one I've seen is that there is rain around and they could get showers, so it could be very testing by Saturday. That's a guess. I mean, we don't know. But neither Capri or Crystal Ocean have been beyond a mile four. I think at the prices, you need to take them on. I don't think Crystal Ocean's form at Glorious Goodwood amounts to much. It was a small field. It was workmanlike. I mean, he's a typical Michael Stout improving galloper. He looks like he'll relish the longer trip, but I'm not sure his form's good enough. And Capri had sort of been a forgotten horse, Raiden O'Brien, this summer until he went to the Curragh last time. He showed a terrific attitude there. But again, they all finished in a heap. He had a hard race. He's up 2 furlongs in trip. The ground's going to be testing. I know he doesn't mind testing ground, but it's different over a mile six. 6-4, the pair couple, back or lay, I'd have to lay them both. And I think the one is the one you touched on, the one I fancy, although his price has come down a bit in the last week, is Defoe. He comes from a yard, Roger Varian, they're absolutely flying. He's gone from 88 to about 120 now in the handicap this year. I think he's improving. The further he goes, the better he gets. He loves soft ground. The stable's winning with everything. I think it's a completely different line of form to all the average group race form that all the others have been running in, and I think he'll improve past them. And I think at 5-1, he's worth a bet.
Okay, so Defoe, who's been well-backed, not necessarily in terms of actually bookmakers taking money, but more so that he'll be suited by the ground, and so they've just been, by default, cutting him. But he's certainly one of the talking horses of the whole meeting. Neil, you've heard from Stephen, and his assessment seems to be to try and lay at least the front two of that trio in the market, Capri and Crystal Ocean, and go with Defoe. You have been a bookmaker on the rails. You have a multitude of runners who go around placing bets for you. What is your way of approaching this race?
Well, first of all, my way of approaching lots of races is to think, is this going to be a good each-way race from a punter's point of view? And I actually don't think this one will be a very good one at all for each way bet. So my interest in the race is likely to be via betting exchanges. So that brings us nicely to Matchbook. And yeah, I looked at, actually, funnily enough, whether laying a couple here might not be a bad idea. You know, this is a traditionally a tough time of the season for punters. Obviously, these horses, there are some lightly raced ones, but, you know, we get to the end of the season, horses have had have been on the go a long time, and the going's, pretty rotten. I sort of was looking a bit further down the list. There's a horse I bet in the Derby, trained by O'Brien, not the same one, Rekindling, which I quite liked here. I thought that had a chance. And I was kind of thinking about saying to you, we should bet that. But I don't mind the idea of laying the front two. I would have been, personally, of the two, I was kind of more against Capri than Crystal Ocean. But I definitely agree that, Defoe would be perhaps more interesting of the two. Venice Beach is another one I was kind of looking at. I mean, that has got form with the latest champion, the Wonder Horse, hasn't it? It finished second to Cracksman last time. And
his run in the Grand Prix de Paris was a fine run as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's up in trip. But the one thing about that is it'll really like the ground. So if it does, it is a bit soft there. I didn't think it looked that soft there today, but there might be some more rain before the weekend, and they're calling it soft. So I guess we have to assume that. And I sort of thought that was interesting. But it certainly wouldn't be a race I would be going overboard on. I haven't played anti-post in it. I definitely won't have a bet until the day. And right now, I'm kind of feeling like I might throw a couple of smallish wind darts on the day. I definitely won't be betting each way. But if Stephen wants to say, why don't we try and lay kind of 6-4 coupled, or even, if we have to go a bit bigger and get close to laying 13-8 coupled the front two, I wouldn't be against that idea.
Just before we fully go into that idea, I would just say, you were talking about Rekindling. His price is about 10-1. Part of that is going to be to do with the fact that he absolutely bombed in the Derby when he was quietly fancied by some, but he never handled the track that day. And Joseph O'Brien has talked about that. He was all at sea at Epsom. He then came out and won when they upped him in trip. And last time out, he finished second, having to give away a penalty. It was the bizarre system of the race. He had to give away a penalty to Order of St. George. He finished second to him, and we saw what he did in the Irish St.
Yeah, I think he's a little bit of a forgotten horse.
Yeah,
there,
I completely agree.
I mean, he is lightly
you.
Raced, and you know, it's not one that people have been talking about much.
What price is Rekindling on Matchbook, Jesse?
You're going to get about you're going to get about 11s or 12s, I think. And I mean, obviously, I will say, with the horses we've been backing in those ranges lately, we've been doing very well by posting and seeing if we can get something when it moves. I mean, last week, for instance, we managed to get that Mystery Mountain at something like 17s when it was 13s when we were talking. So if we did want to go Rekindling, I'd want to put in something like 13s or 14s and try and get lucky.
I put in a strong word for Rekindling. I really like him.
I'm very tempted by the idea of laying these top two, but I guess you guys are saying that, you don't think that those top two take up 40% of the market. I wonder what the edge would be there. Do you think they would take up, say, 33%? I mean, you wouldn't be laying them at 1-3 on, would you?
No.
For me, I need to know that I fancy a few in the race before I want to start laying a favourite again. And this is effectively a favourite, a 6-4 favourite if we lay the two. And I do fancy a few in the race. You know, I can make a case for Coronet, I can make a case for Defoe. I actually quite like the idea of laying the front two. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, I think 6-4, there's 1,000 6-4 chances every month, isn't it? And 6-4 these two, it does look a very thin price. There is depth to the race. I mean, it's not like there's 5,000 or 6,000 to 1 chances. Even the sort of 20, 25 to 1 chances have got claims, And as Neil said earlier on, it's the time of the season where bookmakers, the ground has suddenly gone from summer ground, fast ground form. It's now soft and testing suddenly. We've had a lot of rain in the UK, and it is a time bookmakers are looking to traditionally get back all their losses from the sort of summer months, where usually the ground rides fast and the form works out. So I think 6-4 is a thing. Maybe for matchbook purposes, we'd be better up off putting up an order to back, say, Defoe at 6-1 and Rekindling at 14-1 and see if they get taken. Maybe that's a better strategy for our purposes.
We'll have a think about it. We haven't done this very often, and it sounds like this might be a good time to try this strategy. We don't have to go overboard, but I love getting my laying hat on.
Okay, so laying two of the front three in the market looks like the appealing play for Jesse May. But no spoilers. We'll find out a little bit later on in the show which way Jesse wants to play it. That is our look at the St. Ledger. It's live on At The Races and ITV 3:35 at Doncaster. It should be a cracking race. Enjoy it. My thanks to Stephen Harris.
Thanks a lot, guys.
And Neil Channing, thanks for sticking around for the horse racing as well. We'll chat to you again next week.
Thank you.
So we've heard from the experts in the NFL, from the Premier League, just now from the lads for the St. Ledger at Doncaster as well. We should say, if you didn't get enough of an NFL fix today, and we got so much great content from Todd Furman, from Mike Carlson, and from Neil Channing, but if you want even more, check out Matchbook site, insights.matchbook.com. Stephen O'Rourke, Adam Chernoff, and Brad Allen are on this week.
Let me say, Emmett, just about that. First of all, great stuff from those guys last week.
4-1.
They went 4-1 in their picks. I was on Brad Allen's pick on the Jags. I know he's picked out three unders this week, and I think his content was really strong, as was Chernoff's. I mean, all three of them. So, with that talk from Todd about the unders, you might want to check out Brad Allen, who's very hot right now.
Yes, spoiler alert, he's going unders in three games for week two. Also, reminder once again about the NFL offer for Matchbook.
Right, it's 10% bonus on your winnings if you bet on the app in play on New Orleans and New England. And basically, if you're out and about for the game, which you should be, 6 o'clock on a Sunday, you will want to be betting in play specifically because New Orleans is going to have to probably go down and then come back, and we're going to be on the over anyway.
Unfortunately, we didn't have time to talk to Matt Damon on the show this week, the old Jimmy Kimmel joke. But we also didn't have time to do the golf. But there is an excellent preview again on insights.matchbook.com for the BMW Championship, so you can check that out on the site as well. Right, brought together by their shared views on maximizing expected value, Matchbook have partnered with Reg, raising for effective giving. They are the charity of choice for many professional poker players. They use science and rational decision-making to maximize expected value when helping to reduce suffering in the world. At the start of Season 2 of the Matchbook Betting Podcast, the good folks at Matchbook generously gave us £5,000 for a betting account. Last week, it was very healthy. Jesse May, what's it like now?
Uh-oh. Well, we took a slight step backwards. I mean, we're at 49.03. I will say, though, a bit of a hard luck story last week because we had two big horse racing bets. We got a second and a third.
Yeah.
We didn't go for the East Way. Maybe we should have gone place. I don't know. But I think that if you were listening to the show and you did get out there on the each way for either of those bets, you had a winning week. So good for you. And also, a couple of the bets we made that we have action on are looking quite good. We got on Chelsea at 6.5. That's come in for a profit now if we traded in. And we're looking good on our Houston unders as well. So still feeling good, even though we're about 100 pounds down for the season.
All right, we're going to recover this weekend, though. So you've heard from the lads. We've decided to change things up this weekend. Instead of you announcing straight away while the lads are talking what bet we're going to do, we're going to, now that they're away, Jesse, now that they're off the line, you can we can say what we really think. So what's your thought process? You've heard from Todd, from Mike, and from Neil in the NFL, from Stephen and Neil on the racing, and from the two Marks on the Premier League. What do you want to do?
I don't know if I'm just overconfident or good mood, but I thought a lot of good cases made, and I really want to get into most of the stuff that we heard. I really liked what Stinchcomb and O'Hare were saying about the soccer, although the Chelsea-Arsenal game felt a slight bit marginal to me. So we're just going to go – we're going to put a small bet there, stuck it through the Kelly criterion. We will hit – take O'Hare's advice and go for the three quarters of a goal handicap. putting a bid in there. Just going to post and see if it gets matched at 2.09 for £50. But then I thought the other two games were sounded a bit stronger cases, and I like the angles because they're both kind of public angles. So we're going to hit the West Brom at 2.06 on the minus a quarter goal, and we're going to hit that for £100, and then that'll be our big bet. We're going to hit under 3.0 on the Tottenham Swansea game for 2.04 for £75. We're actually going to grab that price and not post because it sounded like that might disappear.
Yeah, it did. It's probably the smart move to try and take that now by the sounds of things. That's the Premier League. Horse racing then. What do you want to do with the St. Ledger?
I just think that, you know, we've been hearing from Neil and Stephen for quite a while, and I'll say two things that you would have to agree. First of all, the boys rarely agree, and second of all, it's not like them to want to take on the top two in a market on the lay side rather than picking out some to back. So I just think that, you know, that with both of them thinking it's a good idea, it's a good time to try it. And you know, if there's a 5% advantage on the entire proposition, that would say we should take about a £300 liability with our bankroll. So we're gonna.
Let me ask you this: what price in the win market and the place market is Rekindling?
Rekindling is. Let's see. I think Rekindling is around we could probably post up there for 13.0 and see if it gets, and they did like that. So I'll tell you what, that's a good point. Why don't we take a slightly smaller liability on these guys and put a small back bet on Rekindling as well?
Yeah, I'd do it that way. I don't like this £300 liability. Capri could absolutely bolt up. I'm telling you, he could bolt up.
What we're going to do is we're gonna post up an offer to lay both Capri and Crystal Ocean, for a stake of around £75 each, and that'll shorten our liability a little bit at a maximum price of 5.0, 4-1, which will get us the 4-6 coupling, and then we'll put £25 on Rekindling. At 13.0 and see if that gets matched and see how that goes.
Okay, on your head be it, sir. On your head be it.
As for the
NFL, what are we going to do there?
I don't know about you, but I thought there were some really great cases made for those games.
Very
strong. Aside from the first one, it just felt to me.
You mean the one like where Neil read Ulysses for half an hour?
Gonna pass on Green Bay Atlanta. Wouldn't want to put anybody else off, but wasn't really sure, if going between over or a road underdog. Not really liking it, but so just gonna pass on that one. But love Todd's angle on the home underdog for Denver, and so we're gonna put £100 on Denver. But definitely going to wait till just before kickoff because it really felt like there was a chance that market is better off moving in our favor than against. So we'll take whatever price we can get on Denver in the handicap towards kickoff. And then in the New England-New Orleans game, it just seems very rare that Todd would feel strongly about the over, and it's a real public game. So we're going to hit for £150, we're going to hit over in the New England-New Orleans. We're just having a look there, even though it's 55.5. 55 is kind of a key number, so we're going to post up there and try and lay a little bit. I think we can get around 1.87 or something like that on over 54.5 and grab 55 on our side. So we're going to try and do that. And then the third game we'll have a bet on is the Indianapolis. And like Neil said, I think, you know, we should wait, see if it hits 7.5. We'll actually grab that now and just take the price, because if the money comes in, it'll probably be them making a play on Indianapolis against Arizona. So we'll just take the 7.5 there for £75.
It's going to be an active week for the Matchbook betting account.
Oh yeah, yeah. We could easily be broke by October 3rd. But I listen. I think all this stuff has value, and we're following the Kelly calculator. We're just sticking in. Around right now, we're looking at between 0.5% and 2% for the soccer as far as an edge goes. We're looking at around 2% for the NFL and around 5% for the horse racing, and we'll hope it goes well.
And remember, bet smart with Matchbook. We could be broke by October. For goodness sakes, Jesse.
I mean, what a like that. And I was being a flip there. We're betting off a percentage of the bankroll and following our Kelly calculators. So if we do start to go down, we'll still be betting the same kind of percentages, but our stakes will change. So right now, we're betting, most of our bets are between 1% and 2.5 to 3% of our bankroll. And if we start going behind, we're just going to have to suck it up and not keep the stakes the same, but keep the percentages of the bankroll the same. We're going to commit to that.
I like it, Jesse May. I like it a lot. You're on a flight. You are not doing the Mark Stitchcomb thing of flying to Florida, which is probably for the best, to be fair. But you will be back with us live and kicking next week.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And watching every game this Sunday with abandon.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. It's so great having the NFL back. And there's so much content on Sky as well. And there's also content in other places too, but particularly on Sky. They've just got so much to show us. Jesse, pleasure as always. Thanks so much to all our contributors. Some great content this week. Hopefully, it's going to be a profitable week for the Matchbook Betting Podcast, and we'll send things again in the right direction. From Jesse May.
Best of luck, everyone. Bet smart. or try to. Try your best. I know I do.
Hold on a second. You're not selling me that story about at least I tried to. I'm reliably informed that you and a number of other unnamed podcasters were getting stuck into the Saints on Monday night.
It's true. And I was gonna use that word of caution, which is that I was just gonna say that I actually had a great weekend betting, listening, thinking, and then betting. But where you don't want to make the mistake, and we all know what happens, is thinking that just because you're sitting at a pub and watching a game on the TV, you have to have a bet on it. And it wasn't really the bet so much as the reasoning behind the bet, which was that it's on the TV and it's my fifth pint. And, win or lose, when you do that, you know what's going to happen.
And you kept going in. You kept topping up for more. So.
It was. I made it into a buffet bet. I went back three times for more food.
To be fair, though, you had made the Green Bay Packers a buffet bet. So to be fair, you kept topping up on them. So you at least you'd had a good end to the weekend.
I think any guys out there, you can sympathize or at least identify. If you do make a mistake, if you wake up the next day and say, I shouldn't have done that, you got to forgive yourself and you got to move on, and that's just try harder the next time. So this weekend, it's going to be all shrewd.
I now have an image of Jesse May just staring into the hotel room mirror, just going, I forgive you, Jesse. I forgive you for last night's bets.
That's it, baby. As Doyle Brunson said, win, win, win.
Right, that's it. We're done. From Jesse May and from me, Emmett Kennedy, thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts would be a huge help. It just spreads the word about the show. We've got great contributors lined up again for next week's show as well. But for now, hopefully you have a great betting weekend. Thanks very much for tuning in. We'll chat again next week. God bless.